And they are literally hanging from the rafters. The standing room only signs went out early. The SRO signs went out early here, as it's a happening. It's Saturday morning wrestling. Day of the week when we forget what's happening in the real world and go back to the days of our childhood and our youth and look back and realize, damn, we wasted a lot of time watching wrestling, didn't we? It's Jim Valley. It's Saturday Morning Wrestling. Well, Rich Patterson was one of Playboy Buddy Rose's best friends. And Rich was a radio guy like me. I met him when I worked at KEX in Portland. And KEX is like the heritage station. You know, so if you live in Denver, it'd be the equivalent of KGO or, you know, the deal. Whatever station your dad and your grandparents listened to, that's the station that we worked at. And so Rich knew a lot of the wrestlers and things, and he's been going to wrestling for, gosh, I don't know, since the late 60s, early 70s at least, if not longer, because he is older than I am. And so Rich will be on the show today, and we'll talk about, for example, when Playboy Buddy Rose died, and I think we've talked about this before, but Buddy was very big on technology, and Buddy was an early adopter of things, and Buddy was an early adopter of VCRs, like when they were like humongous, like when they were the size of like a microwave. And Buddy would go home and he would tape his Portland wrestling stuff. So virtually every bit of the Portland wrestling footage that you see on YouTube is from Buddy Rose's collection, which came from Rich Patterson. When Buddy died, his widow gave Rich all of the collection. And then Rich also helped Buddy while he was alive transfer a lot of it to digital, including Buddy was such an early adopter of technology that a lot of the tape in the beginning was a technology that doesn't even exist anymore. Not even, I mean, something that predates, you know, you probably know VHS and Beta maybe, but this stuff predates VHS and Beta, and I don't even think I know the name of it. I mean, it's so early and so obscure that that's how it came into Rich's hands, and he was able to, like, send it across the country to someplace, and it cost, like, quite a bit of money, but he was able to do that. So, matter of fact, he just got footage. He hasn't made it public yet, but he did get footage of brand-new footage that's all crystal clear and clean of Buddy Rose throwing the Pacific Northwest Championship off of one of the larger bridges in Portland, like just right in the middle of downtown. You know, there's a river through the middle of downtown Portland, and there's a number of bridges. And so Buddy went across one of the bigger bridges, the Fremont Bridge in Portland, and threw it off the Fremont Bridge, the old title, in 1980. And that was quite a big deal. He got a lot of publicity and made traffic stop on the bridge, and there were even fans there waiting for him. And Rich showed me the footage of this stunt, which Buddy got from an idea from Fidel Sierra, who was the assassin at the time. You would know him from maybe Nitro, or anyway, Fidel Sierra, Dave Sierra. And Paul Jones threw a title belt off of a bridge in Florida, and that's where Buddy got the idea. And so Rich showed me this footage, and all the bad guys pull up in this, maybe it's a limo, maybe it's a town car, I don't remember. But so you've got Rip Oliver, the assassin, and Buddy Rose, who were all the top three bad guys in Buddy Rose's army. And Buddy gets out of the car, and of course, the wrestling fans, being that it was 1980 and people aren't as evolved as they are now, they of course say terrible things about them and make some rather homophobic slurs, because it was 1980, kids. Who knew? I remember being a kid there thinking that we were all evolved and proper people, but obviously we're not. We had a lot to learn. Lots and lots and lots to learn. So we'll talk to Rich coming up in, I don't know, a little bit coming up here. We'll talk to him, and if you have questions about Portland wrestling, this is one of the things that I'm doing, is because it's my understanding that, you know, of all the territories, a lot of stuff has not been covered nationally in Portland, because we're just kind of up here in our little corner of the world, and not a lot is known, so hopefully I'll get the word out and educate you about Portland wrestling, the wrestling I grew up on. And you can, I don't know, you can complete your wrestling knowledge. You can really be smug with your wrestling. You can be the smuggest nerd in Nerdville of all the nerd time. So there you go. If you want to call up, it's 646-721-9828, 646-721-9828. Or you can email at pwtorchlivecast@gmail.com, or you can find me on the Twitter machine at Jim Valley, J-I-M-V-A-L-L-E-Y. I want to mention that the PW Torch Livecast is brought to you by the VIP method of the signing up for a PW Torch. You get all the content, all of the radio shows, all of the fun stuff, all of the ridiculous amount of news and columns and analysis and everything that we have at the Torch. And it's a great thing. So be sure to sign up for VIP. And we'll take your calls at 646-721-9828. Coming up next.
If you're a fan of the PW Torch Livecast, you might want to consider a PW Torch VIP membership. When you do that, you get access to an exclusive RSS feed of not only ad-free, plug-free versions of every single PW Torch Livecast, but also over 50 other VIP exclusive podcasts per month, including the Every Single Day Wade Keller Hotline. I also host three other flagship VIP exclusive podcasts: The Midweek Fix with Todd Martin, The Weekend Bruce Mitchell Audio Show, each about 2 hours in length, and the post pay-per-view roundtables with the 1 hour analysis of every WWE pay-per-view and some other ones too. Also, ad-free access to pwtorchvip.com, and that is mobile-friendly and PC and desktop-friendly. And also access to almost three decades of the Pro Wrestling Torch newsletter, dating back to the late 1980s, over 1,400 back issues, with my pay-per-view reports on every single pay-per-view match since the late 1980s, with star ratings and match descriptions, roundtable reviews from the staff on every pay-per-view, cover stories on the biggest story every single week in pro wrestling, march through them as a VIP member 1 week at a time, read our exclusive Torch Talks with pro wrestling's biggest names, hard-hitting editorials, backstage tidbits you will not hear anywhere else, and much more. It's all available. Check out details at pwtorch.com/govip. That's pwtorch.com/govip. Exclusive podcasts, exclusive new newsletters every week, ad-free access to our website, and access to 28-plus years of archives. It's all waiting for you if you go VIP. Find out more details, a checklist of all the benefits of being a VIP member, along with testimonials from current members and a sign-up form that's mobile-friendly. Takes about 90 seconds to sign up. Go check it out today, pwtorch.com/govip. Do you shop at amazon.com? If so, do you know there's a way for you to support the PW Torch Livecast without doing anything different other than starting your shopping at pwtorch.com/amazon? When you go to pwtorch.com/amazon, click on the Amazon link, and you land at the Amazon homepage. But anything you buy on that shopping trip, we get a commission for. It's a way to throw a few extra quarters, maybe a couple bucks in the tip jar, as a way to say thanks for what we do here at the PW Torch Livecast. So next time you're about to shop at Amazon, don't type in AMAZ. Stop right there and type in pwtorch.com/Amazon. That's pwtorch.com/Amazon. A free, easy way to help support what we do here at the Livecast. Thank you.
And we're back on the PW Torch Livecast, Saturday Morning Wrestling with Jim Valley, and let's run to the phone line. Let's go to 816-816. You are on the Livecast with Jim Valley. Who's this and where are you calling from?
Travis from Kansas City.
Travis, what's going on in Kansas City today?
Not much. I just had two really quick questions. When it came to the Central States Wrestling Territory, was that ran by Bob Geigel, or was that owned by, ran by Harley Race?
Both. They were partners. So they, Bob Geigel and Harley Race, Bob Geigel ran it because Harley Race was often the NWA champion and wrestling around the world, but Harley Race was also an owner in Kansas City.
And then my other question,
And then you also had Pat O'Connor in there as well. Pat O'Connor also had some points in Kansas City. I think Vern might have as well.
Okay, and then my other question is, I'm going to school right now. We're reviewing the Kristen Wall family tragedy. Where would I go to find the Torch's coverage of that?
When did it? Was it 2007?
Yeah, I believe that's what it was.
Yeah, I would look up the date that it happened. I think it was Yeah, it's, I think we're coming up on 10 years. It's 2007, so I would go to the PW Torch, the VIP archives of the Torch newsletters, and if you find the right date, you can just bring up the – you can go to the actually, you can also go to the year, go to 2007 and go through – there's a very quick thumbnail of each Torch newsletter, and you can probably find them just at a quick glance and find all the Benoit coverage that's in there. But there is – there is a lot of Benoit coverage when that happened, man. That was heartbreaking, and it was tragic, but it also, you know, it shouldn't have happened, and it's sad that it happened. But fortunately, a couple of good things for the industry did come out of it, so it was only 99% bad, I guess.
Right. It is too bad that it happened. And the other thing, is, as far as the NWA goes, where can you go to see some of that footage? Because I didn't see any of it on the network. I'm guessing the WWE doesn't own that library.
The NWA, the National Wrestling Alliance?
Yeah.
Well, the NWA was different. It was like a club of different promoters. So there isn't there's Crockett stuff that's on there, and if you go to the vault, you can see NWA World Championship Wrestling, which was the Saturday, what I guess is now known as the 605 show. And that's NWA. You can watch that. And then there's some early pay-per-views under WCW pay-per-views. I think because technically the NWA still exists, they don't want to acknowledge it too much. But the early pay-per-views from Starrcade 83 all the way up to, I guess, 87, that's all NWA pay-per-views. And then it switched, obviously, when Turner bought it out. But you can go to YouTube, and, like, for example, the stuff we're going to talk about today, Portland was an NWA territory. So you can go to YouTube and Google Portland Wrestling, and Portland was NWA. I've been watching a ton of Florida right now with Dusty Rhodes, and I guess right now it's the 80s, so it's got Billy Jack Haynes and Superstar Billy Graham and Kevin Sullivan and Barry Windham and Mike Rotunda and Outlaw Ron Bass and stuff, and that was in NWA territory. Okay. So you can do that if you can go to YouTube and you can find a lot of the shows. There's a great group of shows, a great playlist, and I've talked about this before, but it's called 1984, A Year in Transition, I believe. 84, A Year in Transition, and you can watch. Has Jim Crockett Promotions switched from Dory Funk Jr. being the booker to Dusty Rhodes, and it's the build-up from Starrcade 83 all the way up to Starrcade 84, and they just show you a lot of clips of things like Don Kernoodle and Sergeant Slaughter and Wahoo McDaniel and Tully Blanchard and Ric Flair and Dusty Rhodes and just a whole bunch of stuff. So those are some good places to get started.
Thank you.
You bet, Travis. Thanks for the call, man. I appreciate it. There's Travis dialing up at 646-721-9828. 646-721-9828. Let's go to 336. 336, you're on the live cast. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Jim, it's Britt Whitmire. How are you, my friend?
I'm good, brother. What's up with you?
Well, I understand that Rich has some extremely rare footage. It's never been seen before. It's a Portland wrestler checking a girl's ID before going out with her.
It wouldn't surprise me. You know what Buddy does have? Have we talked about this?
No.
You're still there? Did you hang up? Okay. So Buddy, the other thing that I always tease Rich about, he didn't get this, but Buddy would talk about it openly. And I always tease Rich about this, is that, you know, wrestling, obviously wrestlers didn't lead the cleanest of lifestyles, and they would often, sleep with the female fans, or I guess probably male fans too, if that's what their proclivity was, if that's what they were into, whatever. But Buddy would take Polaroid pictures of each of his conquests, and he had a box full of Polaroids of all of his conquests. And apparently he got that idea from, of all people, Nick Bockwinkel. So every time Rich always brings up that he's got his videotapes I always joke, hey, when are you going to show us the box of Polaroids you got? Which he never got, but it's just funny to say.
How many mothers and grandmothers are in that box of pictures?
That's a really creepy and oogie question. Thanks for sending that shiver up my spine, Rich. Oh, God, yeah, Brit. So anyway, so apparently Bockwinkel did the same thing, which is really funny because you think of Bockwinkel as this elder statesman and this guy who was so dignified and really, you know, was a great ambassador for wrestling. And then, you know, the truth is that he was just as bad as the rest of them. He just hit it better than the others.
Outstanding. Well, Jim, yeah, I got to run. Looking forward to seeing you in Charlotte, okay?
All right, man. We'll see you soon, Britt.
Take care.
There's Britt Whitmire. I dialed up at 646-721-9828. Yes, Buddy Rose and his box of Polaroids. Yeah. You know, I've got a friend of mine who's a really good friend. He works for Fuji Camera, and they just came out with the Instax, which is a new version of the old Polaroid camera where the film, you know, comes out. So you get this whole generation who has never seen Polaroid, who just knows, you know, getting film on their camera, taking a picture with their camera. But according to my friend, there are two markets for the Instax camera. You know, one is young girls who like to take the pictures and then, you know, stick the pictures up innocently enough on their lockers or, you know, in their bedrooms or share them with their friends. And, you know, they use them for innocent things, you know, things that, you know, that young kids growing up should do. And then there's the older guys who use the pictures for, well, the same thing Buddy Rose used the pictures for. So, yeah, when you kids think you've all been wild and crazy, you're not the only ones. Oh, kids these days, their iPhones taking pictures, sending naked pictures over Snapchat. Yeah, well, Buddy Rose had the analog Snapchat, so there you go. It's true. Look what you learned today, kids. So how was your day today? Oh, Jim Valley told me that Buddy Rose used to take naked pictures of all the ring rats. Oh, that's nice. It's true, though. Anyway, Buddy Rose, a good guy, a legend in Portland, and we'll talk about all the things he did. He did do a lot of good things for Portland wrestling, so there we go. I did want to talk about something while we still got a chance before Rich comes on, but as I mentioned earlier, I've been watching a lot of, there's a guy, God, what's it called? I'll look it up for you so you can look it up, but there's a guy who's been loading up a lot of hours of Florida footage from the late 80s. There it is. It's by 4 Wrestling Fans. It's the number 4 and then Wrestling Fans. And he's been doing the best of championship wrestling from Florida, and it's like the early 80s, and right now he's in 1984. And so, like, he's Billy Jack and Superstar Graham are fighting over the Florida title, and they just had the famous show in Miami, the Orange Bowl, the Lord of the Rings, with Dusty Rhodes beating Ric Flair in a non-title match where you get, like, some fake $100,000 prize, and then you get a ring, like a Super Bowl ring. So when you see, like, Battle Bowl and all that stuff in WCW, that's where it came from, because Dusty loves football and wanted a Super Bowl ring, but he couldn't beat Ric Flair, so he had to beat him for something that's even more prestigious, the Lord of the Ring. But so anyway, so I'm watching Florida, and it's good. You know, it's interesting, and it's good to see finally after all these years. But, you know, I don't know if this has happened to you, but if you grew up on the magazines, and, you know, the magazines are different than say, Wade Keller, who will tell you if something sucks or something needed work or if something was great, or, you know, he's much more honest about everything. But in the magazine era, everything was amazing, of course. Everything was the greatest of all time, and everything was, you know, this guy was great, and that guy was great. Everybody was great. It was all great back in the magazine era. So, you know, as a kid, you'd see these pictures or read about these cards and everything, and you would just think that it was, you know, you had it in your mind just how amazing everything was. And it was kind of like that with Bob Backlund, because I grew up a fan of Bob Backlund, even though I was in the Northwest and never really got to see Bob Backlund wrestle more than maybe a couple of times on television, maybe. But now, as I go back and see all these things that I had built up in my childhood mind, I go back and see these things for real on YouTube now, 30 years later, whatever it is, I'm like, oh, wow, that kind of sucked. It looks really lame. Like, they had some angle where Kevin Sullivan was going to hit somebody with his golden spike, and Blackjack Mulligan dives in the ring and pushes them out of the way and takes the spike in the chest himself, and it was just the hokiest thing you could ever see in your life. It was so cheesy. It was so awful. It was just cheeseball. So, anyway, I just thought that maybe if you've been watching anything, if there's anything you saw that when it finally came through, you were like, oh, well, that was kind of lame. That was kind of stupid. But at least, I don't know, it was just interesting to see what I had built up in my mind and then what the reality was. I went through that same thing when I finally saw the cage match with Ric Flair and Kerry Von Erich on Christmas night. When you saw the Texas Stadium matches, everything just, I had in my mind how amazing everything was. And gosh, Portland wrestling in my mind was just so rinky-dink because the magazines never covered it. But really, God, Portland wrestling had some really great stuff now looking back. Portland wrestling holds up a lot better than some things, and I think it's because the Portland wrestling never got really ridiculous. It was just blood and guts wrestling. You know, we didn't have someone who worshipped Satan. We didn't have, you know, goofy skits or anything. It was just promos and maybe a confrontation in the interview area, which was called the Crow's Nest, by the way. So when Rich references the Crow's Nest, that's what he's talking about. But as we go back and look back at some of this nostalgia, I don't know, maybe it's a different era now, because when you read about things, you know, people are much more honest about them now and more straightforward. So maybe you don't have the same idea that, oh my God, this is the greatest thing ever. Or maybe you go through the opposite, where you see how something is so terrible, and then you finally watch it and you hear how terrible it was. You go, oh, that wasn't so bad. That wasn't as bad as everyone thought. Or maybe everyone thinks it's so, so awesome, and you're like, really? That was it? That was all? And you're just kind of like, meh. But maybe that's one of the reasons I'm grateful for Portland wrestling, is because really, in hindsight now, it was really great stuff. It was never really too stupid. I mean, it's wrestling, so there's always going to be one level of stupidity. But it still wasn't as bad as some, and you didn't see a lot of cheesy angles or stupid weapons or, you know, awful skits or those type of things. So it worked out pretty well. So hopefully today we can educate you about a territory you don't know a lot about, Portland wrestling. And as time goes on, I'm going to see if I can get, I'll bring the grappler back on and we'll talk just exclusively about Portland, and we'll bring in some more people and talk some Portland as we can, so I can kind of just pass the history of Portland wrestling on to you. So, because there do seem to be some people who are interested, and also, you know, it's good education. Stories you haven't heard, like Buddy Rose and his Polaroids. And speaking of Buddy Rose and his Polaroids, joining us now live from Portland is a longtime Portland wrestling fan. He works for the Portland Trailblazers now, longtime radio guy, which is how I met him. And one of Buddy Rose's best friends joining us now, Rich Patterson. Good morning, Rich.
Good morning, Jim. How are you doing?
I'm great. It's great to see you. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Hey, I wasn't going to mention it, but I did mention to someone about Buddy Rose's collection of Polaroids.
I know nothing about those at all.
Yeah,
those were not part, that was not part of his videotape his wrestling videotape collection. So I know nothing about the Polaroids.
Or the
selfie videos that he got when he first got a video camera. No, nothing about those.
Oh, good God. I didn't know about that, actually. I got to go take a shower now, so you can just talk for an hour. How about that?
Yeah. Well,
Buddy was a funny guy, man. He was a unique guy.
Now, Jim, I'm not sure. How well did you know Buddy?
I knew Buddy pretty well. I mean, particularly when I did, remember I did the radio show in Portland in the early 2000s?
That's right.
That's how I got to know him. And then we sort of had a stupid falling out that I regret, but I think it was just one of those things. What was I going to say? So, I mean, you know, he and I hung out a little bit, not as much as probably other people, but, you know, and I liked Buddy. I mean, he did a lot of great stuff for wrestling in Portland and for a lot of people in their careers and stuff, and you have to respect it. And I think generally, even with all of his weird proclivities, that you know, I think by and large he was a pretty good guy.
Yeah, I would agree. And there, if there were people that followed Portland wrestling web pages on chat pages on some of the internet pages that were so popular when the internet kind of first exploded. Buddy would had a number of different personas that he would have on these chat rooms and message boards, and he didn't like it when people would talk badly about him. And I'm trying to remember now some of his personas that he had.
Oh,
it's been so long ago. Pardon me?
Truth Lady. The Truth Lady.
Yes, that was one. And God, but there were times when I would literally get a call from Buddy at 1 o'clock in the morning saying, Rich, this guy just posted this, you got to post this about it because it's just wrong. And boy, he took it so seriously. It was almost scary, but that was one of the fun parts of his personality too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that was kind of the tail end of Buddy's career where, you know,
right.
I mean, he got really heavy. He was very sedentary. And he didn't do a lot, and I think it's just general, someone just messaged me from Portland, a reality check was another one.
Reality checking, that's it. Thank you, reality check.
Thank
yes.
you, Jared, reality check. Yeah, that was another one. So, yeah, he would go on all of these old message boards and post under different names, and I think he fooled about zero people. But,
well, he did it too often, and it became too obvious. Reality
yeah.
check is the one that really stands out now because there were times
yeah.
I didn't know it was him initially, and I'd say, "Who in the hell is this guy?" God, you know, and he was obnoxious. But then after Buddy told me it was him, then it all clicked. It made sense.
Yeah, yeah. Buddy was, Buddy was sedentary at that time, not really doing much. And you know, there's probably some person in all of our lives that we know that. You know, they could probably be a little bit more active these days, and that's kind of what Buddy came by for at the end. But well, I don't want to talk about that stuff at the end.
And one thing in Buddy's defense too, he was fighting diabetes, and that was something that I think did not help him keep the weight off. He had some health issues that initially were brought on by the weight, and also were hereditary. So. It wasn't all his fault. Of course, he could have done something to stay in better
yeah.
shape. But, you know, that's Buddy. And the one thing we can talk about as we move on is through the tapes that were unearthed through Buddy's collection, I think that people who started following wrestling in the 90s and in the 2000s, when you'd say Playboy Buddy Rose, all they would know is blowaway diet.
Yeah, I hate that.
And I do too, but oddly enough, Buddy loved it because people remembered him.
Right.
But his wife hated it because they only thought of her husband as this big bloated pile of goo
comedy.
Who made fun of himself.
Right, this big fat comedy character, yeah.
That's exactly it, and it hasn't been since all these videos of Buddy have come to life that people who weren't around Portland, weren't familiar with Portland, realized, God, this guy was a hell of a worker.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I want to talk about, and just not only a hell of a worker, but a hell of a mind as far
yeah.
as, you know, all of the things that he did and all the people that he brought into Portland and who went on to greater things because of Buddy's help. Hang on one second. there's a lot there in that sense, and it does bug me. It's sort of like with the Iron Sheik, where it's like every time you bring up the Sheik, you know, even though he's clean now and everything, or anything he's done in the past, there's always Sheiky Baby, and there's always Make Him Humble, and that whole thing, and it's Howard Stern era, and it's kind of comparable in the sense that, you know, Buddy was more than 217 pounds in the blow-away diet. Maybe we can expand your knowledge after we're done with this conversation. So let's talk about you real quick. And when did you start watching Portland wrestling?
My earliest memory of Portland wrestling would probably be around 1969, 1970. My family watched it. And so I grew up with it being on initially Friday nights and then it's a long time Saturday night spot. And my earliest memory is walking by the TV and seeing this guy, who ended up being Dutch Savage, yelling and screaming about he was going to kill somebody. And Savage, even as a good guy, could be scary when he had a hot interview. And I remember seeing that and being scared of this guy on TV yelling and screaming about going to kill somebody. And that is one of my earliest memories. Another one is being at a relative's house and watching an interview with Lonnie Mane and Tony Bourne in the Crow's Nest. And when they were a team, an extremely successful team, Lonnie wasn't able to talk. Tony wouldn't let him talk. And during this specific interview, Lonnie was trying to talk, and Tony was slapping him around, telling him to shut up, which was par for the course. But Lonnie's dad, Kenny Mane, came up to the Crow's Nest and started telling Tony, don't treat my son like that, so on, so on, so on. Tony decks him. He's all bleeding up in the Crow's Nest, and that starts another Bourne-Mane feud. Those are my two real early memories of Portland wrestling, and I think watching it every week was right around 1971 or so. The first real big feud I remember was the Kangaroos and the Von Steigers.
Which was a great feud. Let's talk real quick. Obviously, tough Tony Bourne, the dad of Matt Bourne, and he and Lonnie Mane were a pretty big deal in the late 60s, early 70s. You know, probably, you know, Buddy would always say that Don Owen told him that until, you know, he made more money for him except for maybe Lonnie Mane, or Lonnie Mane was his biggest draw until Buddy came along, something to that effect.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And they did, you know, for fans who grew up in the 80s, it was sort of like the whole thing. You know, we've seen this a couple of times, but the one that always sticks in my mind is when Rick Steiner was in the Varsity Club. And so, you know, Tony Bourne was the one that got beat up, or was Lonnie Mane was the one who got beat up on it.
Lonnie Mane always got beat up and always got slapped around. He was a stupid one.
Right, he was sort of like the Rick Steiner of the group, and then you wanted him to fight back, and then when he finally fought back, didn't they go? They went to the Coliseum for that match, didn't they?
Yes, they used the Coliseum quite a bit in those days, back in the late '60s, and Bourne Mane was a huge main event, and they got together a couple of times. Well, they broke up for the first time shortly after they. They lost the, I believe it was the AWA titles to, excuse me now, but they lost the AWA titles shortly after that. They had their first breakup, then slowly got back together again after about a year and a half, busted up again in 72. So, they had one of the, not just one of the greatest tag teams, but also one of the greatest feuds of the, like you said, the late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah, and people who are still alive, Tony Bourne stuck around and had an insurance agency and things. Or was it real estate? Which was
it? It was real estate. Cinderella real estate.
Yeah, and he was the local legend. Everyone loved him in town. And, he was definitely, he's a legend in Portland wrestling. And you can't really talk about Portland wrestling without mentioning that. And then Lonnie Mane, he died right about the time I started watching wrestling. I saw one of my earliest memories is when he and I think it was Sam Bass, Ron Bass, lost that loser leave town match, I think, to Rose and Moskowski. And then
December of 77.
There you go. That's about the time when I started watching then. And Lonnie, I would keep up with him through the magazines and things, but then he went down to San Francisco, won the U.S. title, and then died in that car wreck in 78, so it wasn't long after. But Lonnie Mane was, and he's still remembered, too. He was the guy that was, his famous phrase was excitement's in the air, and he was wild and crazy, and he, you look at him, and, he didn't have a great body, But he was this tough guy everyman. And, again, he would say crazy things that would get the people going.
Mm-hmm. And he would eat the – remember for eating the live goldfish on TV? He did all sorts of weird stuff.
Yeah, he ate goldfish. Did he eat glass, too?
I think it was a light bulb that he ate as well.
Yeah. Yeah, and he was hugely popular.
One thing that amazed me about Lonnie Mayne, if you watch video of him, he looks like an old man. He was only 33 when he passed away.
Oh, my gosh, really? I would have guessed 40 at least.
He was only 33 when he passed away.
Wow. And he was Moondog Lonnie Mayne, which comes from the old Dobie Gillis, I presume.
And he was Moondog when he was a heel in L.A. and San Francisco and in Portland. But when he was a face up in Portland, he never used Moondog. There's one interview that I have of him in Portland where he refers to himself as Moondog, and it's like he stopped himself and says, I'm sorry I have to use that, but I really feel it this time. And so, Moondog was his bad guy persona, and just Lonnie Mayne was, when he's the good guy.
And then, like I said, Lonnie Mayne, one of the biggest stars in Portland. And we should mention, like, through the 50s and 60s, I mean, guys like Pat Patterson came through, Nick Bockwinkel, Mad Dog Vachon. There were a lot of talent came through Portland.
Mike DiBiase was here, and Ted DiBiase went to school in Portland for a year.
There you go.
I believe Ted DiBiase went to either second or third grade in Portland while his dad wrestled here.
And, Portland was known for easy road trips and pretty fair payoffs because Don, he was a rancher, and that's where he made most of his money, right?
Exactly, yeah. And that is why a lot of the guys like to work here, because they could sleep in their own bed every night. I mean,
and that was one
a
of the
long trip might be Portland to – I'm sorry?
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say a long trip for the guys might be down to Southern Oregon – to maybe Ashland, Medford, something like that. It's a 300-mile drive, but you can still be in your – if matches end at 10:30, you're back in your own bed by 1, 2 o'clock in the morning.
And that was the thing. It's like you look at, say, the drives in Tennessee or the drives in Louisiana and those kind of things, or Texas even with being so spread out. And, yeah, Portland was a nice territory. It wasn't the biggest money territory, but it was a good lifestyle territory. And people enjoyed coming here, that's for sure. And Don is up there with Sam Mushnick and Paul Bosch as far as some of the most honest payoff guys.
And that I only know that from what you've read, I'm sure, as well. But, yeah, it seemed like he was very honest and kept to his word about if he was going to pay you a certain amount, that was it, and really didn't screw anybody over. People tried to screw him over, but he never tried to screw over his workers.
So as we transition, you talked about Dutch Savage, and Dutch is sort of the grand old man of Portland, even though he was, even before he got older, but he was always, he's sort of like the teacher of the class, I guess. I don't know how to describe him.
I would think so. And he was a real survivor. There aren't, I think every territory has those one or two guys that stick around seemingly forever. Most territories, guys are there for 6 months, a year and a half, maybe at the most, move on. Dutch was one guy that stayed here forever and was able to not really recreate himself, but he was able to adapt to almost any feud that was tossed his way, and I think that's why the fans loved him. He was like the protector of the territory.
Yeah, he'd worked with Bill Watts, and he and Bill Watts were buddies. But, yeah, he was sort of like our Bill Watts, I guess.
Yes. Nobody was going to come in here and mess with Portland. And whether it was a short feud like with Killer Karl Krupp or Professor Dale Lewis, those are some great feuds from the early 70s. They didn't last long, but they were still very memorable. Dutch was the guy on top, and I would say to most people his best feud was with Bull Ramos. That was, I would say, one of the five classic feuds all time in Portland.
Bull Ramis, I remember growing up, everybody was always talking about Bull Ramis, and he was this a real-life Apache Indian, a big barrel-chested guy, and yeah, he was nothing spectacular in the ring, but I mean, shoot, he even got main events in the Garden against Bruno Sammartino. I had no idea until later that his career was as big as it was.
You know, I didn't either, and some big matches in L.A. as well. I had no idea. I thought he was a guy that was big in Portland, and that was about it. But, yeah, a great performer for being as huge as he was. And like you said, barrel-chested, but still able to really maneuver around the ring really, really well. And with working with Savage, that was amazing. And what I learned later on is that a lot of these guys, whether it's not a secret, but you know, best buddies. Dutch and Bull were fantastic friends. Even to the day that the Bull died, they were in contact every day, and they give each other credit for making each other a lot of money.
And then Dutch, of course, also known as the mentor of the guy who I really liked, who got me into wrestling when he was in Portland, and it was just, he was indescribable from everybody else, and that's Jimmy Snuka.
Yeah, well, another guy who really in Portland, this is when I started watching, around the time I started watching Portland wrestling, there was another mentor of Snuka, was Cowboy Frankie Lane, who recently passed away.
And I think he was the one who legitimately brought Snuka into Portland.
Yeah, that was his first tag team partner. And then Snuka left for, I would say, maybe 6 months. And when he came back, there were, Frankie Lane had left the territory. And then it was Dutch and Snuka, and created an amazing tag team for a number of years in the area. And you're right, though. It was Dutch that really helped, I think, promote him to that next level once he returned here. And we all know what Snuka went on to do.
And, I mean, that guy, he was just, I guess you can kind of compare, you know, he was pretty amazing in his New York run and everything, but he was just, I don't know how to describe him. He looked cool. He was jacked to the gills. You know, he looked really cool. He did these amazing moves, and he was just phenomenal. There's no way, he was just so different from everybody else. He was by far the coolest guy in the territory.
Well, and he was unlike anybody else who had been in the territory prior to that time, because you had your guys like Dutch Savage, Lonnie Mane, who they were big guys, but they weren't the big muscle-bound athletic guys. And actually, his first couple of runs in Portland, Jimmy Snuka went by Big Snuka. He wasn't Jimmy Snuka initially here. He was Big Snuka. And but you're right. He was quite different than anybody else. And really, if you think ahead a couple of years, there really wasn't another guy like him that came into the territory until we saw the likes of Jesse Ventura.
Oh, that's right. Ventura was here too. Yeah, I was saying. Oh, yeah, Ventura. The first show I ever went to live had on the card Andre the Giant, Buddy Rose, obviously, Jimmy Snuka, Dutch Savage, Gino Hernandez, Skip Young, and I know I'm leaving people off, but it was just this ridiculous amount of talent.
Yeah, that was it, and that's what people don't realize about Portland. You go back and you look at the roster of guys who were here in 1978. You had guys like Tully Blanchard who got his start here, wrestled for a month or two. Jake Roberts was here for a very short time. That's when Roddy Piper came into the area. You had the Iron Sheik, Jesse Ventura, Jerry Oates, Jimmy Snuka, Jonathan Boyd, Ed Wiskowski, Buddy Rose. It was an all-star lineup that was here in Portland. And people just, it's sad how they're just realizing it now, almost 40 years later, how great the talent was. It was up here in the little old Pacific Northwest.
All right, I want to talk about Buddy's run and how he booked and everything in just a second, coming up here with Rich Patterson. But I want to mention that PW Torch Livecast, sponsored by Loot Crate, a monthly subscription box service. If you love games or pop culture or geeky stuff, For less than $20 a month, you get 6 to 8 items that include licensed gear, apparel, collectibles, unique one-of-a-kind items, and more. You go to lootcrate.com, you enter the code PWTORCH, and you save $3 on any new subscription. You see, Sean Radican does his unboxings every month, all kinds of cool stuff in the crate. And not only that, but Loot Crate has made a deal now with WWE, so not only are you going to get stuff from Star Wars or Walking Dead or Legends of Zelda, you can now get stuff from WWE. Check it out at lootcrate.com. Sign up at PWTORCH. Add that code and save $3 on any new subscription from Loot Crate. So, yeah, we'll talk Buddy Rose. We'll talk some more things like that. And also that crazy Rich is a great guy to have on the show because he can describe to a T the crazy Portland sports arena that we've talked about. Stand by. It's Jim Valley on Saturday Morning Wrestling on the PW Torch Livecast.
When you're looking to tune in live to the PW Torch Livecast, find out about the next episode, or just catch up on an episode you missed, go to our new website, pwtorchlivecast.com. You can select shows by specific day, specific host, and format, including a grid of our latest interviews and best of selections on the homepage. That is pwtorchlivecast.com, where you can stream our show live and listen to past shows on demand. That's pwtorchlivecast.com. If you're like me, you've got a list of favorite websites and a list of favorite podcasts that you visit either every day or throughout the week, but there's probably not a lot of crossover between the two. However, with PW Torch Livecast, that's different. If you're a listener of this show, you should also be visiting our main website, pwtorch.com, loaded with updates covering news in more depth than you'll find anywhere else. Editorials you won't find anywhere else, live TV coverage and pay-per-view coverage that's unmatched, and so much more on a newly redesigned, optimized, lightning-fast website. That's pwtorch.com. Check it out every day and bookmark it. No matter what device you're using, whether it's a mobile phone, a tablet, a laptop, or a desktop, there's a version that fits your screen and customized for your device. Check it out, pwtorch.com, one of the top sources of pro wrestling insider news since 1987 and online as a website since 1999. Don't miss out. Don't just listen to the live cast. In between live cast listens or while you're listening to the live cast, check out the latest headlines and exclusive articles at pwtorch.com.
And we are back here on the PW Torch Livecast, Jim Valley on Saturday Morning Wrestling, and we're talking with Rich Patterson, who's a longtime fan and expert on Portland wrestling. So, Rich, I've tried to describe the Portland Sports Arena, as it was known. what's the best way that you I got to say, like, for example, I think Kurt Hennig tells a story that his first night in the Portland Sports Arena, it's like Buddy Rose wanted him to call him and tell him about his reaction to the Portland Sports Arena. So, I mean, it's quite a venue. Nothing like it, I think, anywhere.
No, I haven't been to many other venues, but I'm willing to bet that it's not like the Portland Sports Arena, which was a bowling alley for many, many years. Don Owen ran his main Portland card out of the Portland Armory in downtown Portland. That was getting closed down, and the city helped him find another place to do his Portland wrestling, and they found a bowling alley that was going out of business in North Portland, and if anybody walks in there, they would immediately think, this looks like a bowling alley, because it was a huge area where you would have all the alleys for the bowling and the steps that you walk down to go and sit. And the thing that always sticks with me, though, and to this day, I haven't been in Portland Wrestling closed down in 1991, but 25 years later, I can still smell the smell of the inside of the sports arena. And it was a combination of burnt popcorn, cigarettes, and some sort of stale beer. It's a church now. It's a church rec hall right now. But I'm sure that those people can still smell that smell in there. And the cigarette smoke just hung in the air. Even on TV, you can see there's a little fog across there. It was one of the most unique venues, I think, that anybody could see for Portland. And if they watch the old videos of Portland Wrestling, they might also see that this isn't really studio wrestling, but it's not really a true arena kind of wrestling. But I think that's what gave Portland Wrestling a lot of its charm, is just the look of it. And people would want to go to the sports arena just to experience what that was all about. And there was a really good atmosphere in there. If you could, you get used to the smoke and the smell and the stale popcorn after a few minutes. It was a great atmosphere in there. The wrestlers had to walk through the crowd to get to the ring. Locker rooms were in the very back of the arena, or I shouldn't say the arena, the building. They had to walk through the crowd, walk down a couple stairs, just like you would at a bowling alley. There are the concession stands. You walk downstairs to get to the alleys. And that's what they had to do. And it was a unique setup, but it was a great setup. And it was our setup, damn it.
And I should mention that it was a very popular place as far as regulars, sort of like back in the day with Madison Square Garden before 85, that the regulars had all the good seats, and they had them each and every Saturday night.
There were some people there that had those reserved seats for years. And I don't know this for a fact, but there is a lady that was a legend in Portland. They called her Ringside Rosie. An old lady that would go down there, and before the matches would start, she'd be down there knitting and doing her, you know, what grandmas do. And then she would turn into a wild woman. And I think every territory must have had somebody like this, because I've seen people like this in videos of other venues. But then she would get up there, she'd whack her hand on the mat, yelling at the ref, yelling at the bad guy, doing whatever. And then she would also be giving all the guys cookies. She'd bring them cookies and cakes. She knew when the birthdays were of all the wrestlers. And that was, she was one of the legends, just as much as Dutch Savage or Jimmy Snuka or Buddy Rose. Ringside Rosie is a Portland Wrestling legend.
Was it Irene? And she had the badge?
Irene was the second Ringside Rosie.
That's what I thought. Okay, that's what I thought. Okay. And
yeah.
Irene was no spring chicken herself.
No. Irene, I think, was there when the commandments were written. So, yeah, she had she'd been around for a day or two. But also, just like Ringside Rosie, she was she did the same gimmick, basically. But
yeah.
You're right. There were same people that were all around there. Another great thing about the Portland Sports Arena that just came to mind, they had so-called security guards. And these guys wouldn't be able to hold back a six-year-old with a pellet gun. You know, there was one guy that was there for many years. He looked like Norm from Cheers. These guys were, I don't know, I guess they were security in name. They wore yellow shirts, and that was it. But if a real fight were to break out there, I don't know what would have happened.
I've mentioned this before about the Portland Sports Arena. It had really low ceilings because obviously it's a bowling alley, and bowling alleys don't have high ceilings. And I think were you there for the match when Dutch Savage took a backdrop and knocked out one of the lights?
That happened a couple of times being tossed up high, and they had the TV lights there, and a couple of times those did get popped out. And I'm really surprised it didn't happen more often, because you're right, it was a very low ceiling, which also helped with the acoustics in there. It would get extremely loud in the arena because of that low ceiling, and it could get extremely loud. But you're right, I do remember when that happened with Dutch, but I'm thinking it happened a couple of other times, and I want to say with one of the Von Steigers, but I can't be 100% sure on that. But I think the guys had to be careful about how they did toss the guys up in the air, because those lights were right there.
Hey, let's go to our version of Ringside Rosie here at the Live Cats. Go to Kylan from New Jersey. Kylan, you got some questions for Rich?
Yes, I do. Question number one, Rich, is in regards to Billy Jack Haynes.
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't Billy Jack Haynes magnetism, for lack of better word, translate over to WWE when he went there in 1986, even though WWE was known back then as less of a work rate territory.
What I think it was with Billy, and sadly, I think he could have been a huge star, but he had some demons, and those demons prevented him from being a real a worker that could be dependent on. He would he would miss matches. He would.
What's that? Uh oh. Well, we apparently have lost a caller. I don't know what happened with Rich there, but we'll wait for Rich to get back. Kylan, are you still there, Kylan? No, Kylan's got some sort of thing going on there. I don't know what that is. I'm gonna cut Kylan off and send him back, see if he can come back there. But we lost. I don't know if we had a little hiccup on the system or what, but we'll wait for Rich to come back, but he will. Speaking of Billy Jack Haynes. So let's talk about Billy Jack. Billy Jack was a Northwest guy who wanted to get started in wrestling, and he hung out with, at the sports arena and things. And Don, for obvious reasons, and a lot of wrestling promoters, didn't like to use local guys because local guys didn't leave. And he didn't want them hanging around if it didn't work out or causing problems if it didn't work out and those type of things. So he was really reluctant to use local guys. And that's kind of a normal Kearney pro wrestling thing that they did. So I don't know. Yes, that's not just Don, but Billy Jack, when he trained and he went up to Calgary and did okay and then came back, and you got to understand, this is the Hulk Hogan era where it's the body era, and Billy Jack had those rugged Marlboro Man looks, and he had the body. And not since Jimmy Snuka had we really had someone who was a body guy as much as anybody else was. So Billy Jack was, jacked to the gills, and no pun intended. And he was really big. And he was big in the Northwest for a while. And I don't know, he came from a really rough background. And Billy, I don't know, it just was one of those things that he just, much of life is not just your skills and your personality, but your soft skills, your ability to get along with people and your ability to be reliable and things like that. And yeah, Billy may have been a big star at some point, but it just, he just bounced around too many places and didn't get along with enough people. Let's go back to Rich. Rich, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hey, I
don't know how much you heard of the my response to the question about Billy Jack.
Yeah, go ahead and talk about. I was kind of talking a little bit about him, but go ahead.
Well, basically, I think that the reason that Billy didn't become the huge star that I think he definitely had the potential of being is because he was not real dependable, and he also had his own ideas. He had demons that he was fighting. Personally, I had never had a bad experience with Billy, but I think now there are a couple of shoot interviews out there that I think make him look like just an idiot, and that's too bad. But my experiences with Billy have been great. I never had problems with him. I can tell you one real quick story about Billy, and that is that when he was really big in Portland. This was in 1985, I believe. My sister was a third grade teacher. Portland wrestling, still huge, huge, huge in Portland. Billy Jack, the number one star. This was at the height of the Billy Jack Rip Oliver feud. And I asked Billy if he would come out and just see my sister's third grade class and visit them because they're all big, huge wrestling fans. He had no problem doing that. Very prompt. We met at a certain spot. We went out there. He was fantastic with the kids, took pictures, signed autographs, did whatever. Other kids around the school wanted to come and see him. He was there forever. There was one little boy who was a huge Billy Jack fan and wasn't able to be there because he was sick. And so his mom brought a video camera. Billy sat down and talked to this boy, sent a message to this boy via the video camera, and was talking to him for maybe 3 or 4 minutes. Extremely sincere, and I'm thinking, God, what a great guy. And when I think about all the bad about Billy, I think about how he took time to send a personal message to this little boy who couldn't see him in person. And then flash ahead a couple weeks later, my sister calls to tell me, have you ever had chicken pox? At the time, I was maybe 23. I hadn't. Bingo, I come down with chicken pox. I have to call Billy and say, Billy, you ever had chicken pox? And thank goodness he had. Otherwise, if he had contracted chicken pox from being in this classroom, there could have been a chicken pox outbreak with Portland wrestlers.
So, yeah, Billy Jack, you know, was really a big star for a while. And I'm watching the stuff from Florida after he went there. And at the time, you know, the early to mid-80s, you know, it seemed like Billy was going to be one of those guys. But for some of the reasons we outlined, that it didn't really happen. So let's talk about your experience. And at what, you know, you were on the radio in Portland. And at what point did you start getting to know some of the wrestlers and becoming more involved with Portland wrestling?
I would say it was around the times of the big extravaganzas that Don Owen put on, the 60th anniversary extravaganzas in 85, that 85, 86, around that time. And I would have the guys come on our local talk show, our sports talk show in Portland. This is in the days when sports talk shows were few and far between. And so our show on KEX in Portland was the only talk show in the area, sports talk show. So we like to have fun and have the guys come in. And Bobby Jaggers is one guy in particular who, in hindsight, I understand a lot of folks did not like at all. I got along with Bobby extremely well. Our FM station, Z100, was the number one station in Portland, top 40 station. He'd come on our show, then he'd want to go over and do something on Z100. And the night jock on Z100, we were roommates at the time. And so then we'd go to the sports arena, and this is when we got to the point to where we didn't have to sit down in the crowd. We could go sit up in the crow's nest, up in the TV area. And, you know, we'd go out drinking with Bobby. A number of stories about, you know, Bobby and his drinking. One night we placed, and he had been cut up that night, and he's K-fab all the way, and he's saying, you know, I don't know how people say that we, you know, cut our foreheads, and I'll give you guys $100 right now if you cut your forehead right now. And of course, we're looking at each other, my roommate and I, going, oh God, no, we, no, I don't know how people could believe that you'd ever cut your forehead. And Bobby, piece of work. Edward Scousey, another guy who we had on a number of times, very good guy. Billy Jack, we had on a number of times. Tommy Zink. But it just got to the point to where being around the arena and knowing these guys and hanging out with them, that just kind of, it kind of snowballed. And then I got to know Buddy around 1990. And that was who, you know, Portland Wrestling was on the wane by that time. And we just hit it off. And he was a big sports fan. I work in sports. And we just kept in touch and were great friends until the day he passed away.
So let's talk about Buddy and what he did for Portland Wrestling and what he meant to Portland Wrestling, in the sense that, by the way, hey, real quick, actually, let's not do that. You mentioned someone just sent an email in at pwtorchlivecast@gmail.com asking about, you mentioned the 60th anniversary show, which I was at. So in 1985, they did this, Don Owens did this show. Talk about that extravaganza, because that is an amazing card when you look at all of the different promotions, the different world titles that were on the card, and even an appearance by Roddy Piper who had just come off of WrestleMania. That's, I mean, just an amazing array of talent that night.
It was amazing, and I think it showed the respect that everybody had for Don Owen, because they came in from these different promotions. Roddy Piper told Vince what he could do with it if he didn't want him to come to Portland, because he wanted to do this for Don Owen, who he obviously respected a great deal. And the big match that night, we had all these world championship bouts. The number one bout that everybody wanted to see was Piper and Rose. Piper hadn't wrestled in the area for, I want to say, He was. He hadn't been a full timer here, I should say, for about 5 years. He would make sporadic trips back in, but this is when everybody knew that he was the big bad guy, the big villain from WrestleMania. But he was still the hated bad guy here. And they had a bet on who would get the most boos. And Roddy, I think if you watch the video, you can see he comes out, and as soon as the crowd just, you have 12,000 people going nuts for him, you can see how he gets this grin on his face, and it's like, they still love me. But the entire card was amazing, and I think, once again, a tribute to how others felt about Don Owen and how Portland fans felt about Portland wrestling. Because this wasn't a peak time for Portland wrestling. This is during start of the downturn when a lot of the talent, top talent, was leaving. But it was still a magical night there at the Memorial Coliseum with all of these fans going nuts for all of these performers from around the area, a lot of whom had never wrestled in Portland. They just saw them on cable. And here they were in Portland doing some great work. It was an amazing night. If you have a chance to watch that, it's on video in various places. Check it out. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's not a great video, but it is there. But yeah, I mean, you had, so the main event, the last match was Billy Jack against Ric Flair for the NWA World Title. Rick Martel defended his world title against Mike Miller, who was a Northwest guy. You had, like you mentioned, Buddy Rose and Roddy Piper, which was, you know, incredible when you think about the war that was going on with Vince McMahon taking over the territories and the NWA, and there's his number one bad guy wrestling on a show. And not only that, he's wrestling as a babyface, a huge babyface.
Mm-hmm.
You had the Road Warriors taking on the Hennigs. You had, you know, Sergeant Slaughter was there with Kendo Nagasaki. There was just, I mean, it was the amount of talent and the number of different promotions and everything was amazing.
Well, and you also look at guys on that card who got their start in Portland. You have Kurt Hennig there. You have Sergeant Slaughter there, who got his start in Portland in 73-74 as his real name, Bob Remus. And Rick Martel, all these guys who got their starts, really got their big breaks in Portland. And I think that was a thing that also was very impressive. Look at some of the talent that they got started here in Portland.
Yeah, Rick Martel came through town. It was was a lot of great talent there. It was an amazing night, and probably, you know, the most historically significant card I've probably ever seen in person, because it was just so rare for all of those things to happen and, you know, never happened again. So yeah, an amazing show, a historical show in the night of Portland wrestling. So, but I want to talk more about Buddy Rose. And one of the things that Buddy always talked about was how, you know, Don never had a booker per se. He never went to someone and said, "Hey," not under, I think he did with Len Denton, but a lot of the stuff was just cooperation. And Buddy was the guy though that came up with a lot of the things that happened on TV and a lot of the angles and storylines.
And Buddy was also responsible for bringing a lot of the guys in as well. He was responsible for bringing in Piper. He was responsible for bringing in Martel. He was responsible for bringing in Jay Youngblood and the Sheepherders. I don't call them the Bushwhackers. Sorry, to me, they're always going to be the Sheepherders. And
fair enough.
And once again, bringing them in and having an idea what to do with them. It wasn't just bringing them in and just seeing what happens. He had a brilliant mind, and how, like you said, there wasn't really a booker, but they had an idea. And Buddy had a great mind for storytelling and how to build up an angle. And I think that the top of that was Buddy's face turn in the summer of 83. How that started, it actually started maybe 3 months earlier, and how it built up. And he had the entire idea. The face turn happened in June of 83, but Buddy's idea for that started maybe back in February and March with a match where Kurt Hennig, puts him out of wrestling for the first time ever. Kurt was the first guy to ever injure Buddy, so he couldn't wrestle. That was the angle. They came back for huge revenge matches, and then all that kind of evolved And it topped off with Buddy turning face, and that was one of the most amazing sights ever on Portland Wrestling, was the night that Buddy turned babyface and the entire ring filled up with fans. That the guy who was quite possibly the most hated person in Portland wrestling history, all of a sudden here he's now the big hero, because he saved Billy Jack and Kurt Hennig from injury from the Klan, and the Dynamite Kid had come in 2 weeks before, was going to be Buddy's new partner, turned on Buddy. So you have all this that just climax right there. And whether you were watch Portland Wrestling as someone who really believed it and took this to heart, or just as entertainment, it was a huge payoff either way. It was an amazing thing. But that just showed what a great storyteller Buddy could be and how he was so important to the territory.
Well, and one of the things I thought that was great about the booking in Portland is nothing ever beat you over the head. Nothing was ever really, really stupid, or, you know, there were no goofy sketches, or, you know, there was a lot of, even back then in the early 80s and late 70s, there was still some goofiness. And looking back now, comparing Portland to a lot of places, it never had those things. It always, you know, no one ever thought it was real, don't get me wrong, but it had an air of believability, and it also didn't really insult your intelligence.
Absolutely not. I can't think of one performer that would come in that you think, this guy is just, you know, no way. It's beyond reality. And a lot of that didn't start in Portland until, I would say, the late 80s, when, because of what the rules put down by the Oregon Boxing and Wrestling Commission, they had to start coming up with weird gimmicks and do screwball things. But up until that time, it was a very, for lack of a better word, serious promotion. It didn't really insult your intelligence as a wrestling fan. And everything seemed to be, I don't want to say legitimate, but it seemed like you could suspend reality and still really kind of believe what was going on.
Yeah, and it all made sense in the context of the world of Portland wrestling.
Yes, it did. There wasn't anything that didn't seem out of whack. I'm trying to quickly go through my head all the years, and I can't think of anything that really would fall into that category. So you're right. It great storytelling, and one thing that I kind of equated Portland wrestling to a number of years ago when some of the footage started to be exposed is, people could compare it to the days of ECW. There was storytelling, lots of violence, lots of blood. And if you like that, you were going to love Portland Wrestling, but just nobody knew about it.
Yeah, it's great. Hey, someone, you mentioned the commission, and we should talk about that, the end of Portland Wrestling when things finally packed up. But there was a lot of issues dealing with the Athletic Commission, and someone has an email about that asking, when did the commission begin to focus on how to negatively affect the promotion? Also talking about Tom Peterson, the main sponsor of Portland Wrestling, going out of business. I guess we can't talk about Portland Wrestling without talking about the legend Tom Peterson.
Absolutely. He started sponsoring Portland Wrestling when Portland Wrestling was actually off TV for a little over a year in 1966 to early 67. When it came back on TV, Tom Peterson began as the number one sponsor, and he's as much, I think, connected to Portland Wrestling as Dutch Savage or Buddy Rose, because his ads played during practically every commercial break during a 90-minute show. Tom would come in and do ads in the arena. He'd bring his refrigerators or his stereos or whatever up to the crow's nest, and Tom's look never changed over the years, still had the crew cut, and he was just somebody. He's a Portland legend. He's as much of a Portland legend as anybody from Portland Wrestling, or any of our mayors, or any celebrity, any kids TV show host. Tom Peterson is a Portland legend.
Yeah, it's I mean, and I think back in the day when you had you know, I guess he would be considered, you know, he was the owner of the company, but he'd be like, he was also the mascot. So it'd be like if Flo from Progressive was a real person or something, because he did kind of wacky commercials. And I don't know, growing
Absolutely.
Up, it seemed like every area sort of had your local crazy, you know, business owner that did memorable commercials, and he was that guy in Portland. And yeah, he loved Portland wrestling. Loved Portland.
Yeah, and it was very good to him. He had wrestlers that would go out there on a number of occasions, and unfortunately, he tried to expand his business a little bit too much in the late 80s, and that led him into bankruptcy. And I don't believe that Tom's financial troubles had a lot to do with the demise of Portland wrestling, but it certainly didn't help.
Right. So let's talk about, and it's very controversial, we should say, that the whole issue with the commission coming down on Portland wrestling, and there were a lot of things going back and forth and back and forth. It was quite the real life feud, I guess.
Well, it was, and I think that the commission had a lot to do with the demise of Portland wrestling, because Bruce Anderson was the person in charge. He was the commissioner, and he was just a scrawny little guy. He used to be a pro boxer in his earlier days, and he used to be a policeman in New York. And the commission was set up by the Oregon legislature to regulate mainly boxing, because there have been some shady boxing promoters in the area. And once boxing kind of went away in the state, they have this commission, so they start focusing on wrestling. And there have been rumors over the years that Billy Jack had something to do with this when he had his own Oregon Wrestling Federation promotion, and that he kind of keyed them in on some things, that, you know, wrestling isn't on the up and up, and we do this and we do that. They came in, and some of the regulations that they did, first of all, they outlawed the use of blood, which for Portland, that was not a good thing. It was a bloody territory. Not every week, but when it was needed, it was used. And so they had to figure out a way to get around that. Then they eliminated chair shots. You could not use a chair as a weapon. And what are you going to do with it? I mean, that's one of the staples of pro wrestling. Then they had the blood tests. And they weren't testing for prescription drugs. My understanding was they were testing for pot and cocaine. And that's when a lot of workers from around the country said, I'm not going to go work in Portland because smoking dope. And that's where a lot of the talent level in Portland started to dwindle a little bit. They also started taking a cut from Don Owen, which, as I recall, Don Owen wasn't that wild about. But it was just a lot of these things that building up that they were taking away what pro wrestling was, especially in Portland. And there's also been rumblings that maybe Vince McMahon had something to do with this as well, because he was trying to break into the Oregon territory and his shows were falling flat. And they do these regulations, Portland starts to falter, he can move right in. The commission started around 1988, I believe, and Portland Wrestling went away in late 91. So it was, I think the commission had a lot to do with changing the way that Portland Wrestling looked and the way that they had to do their thing. And it frankly wasn't nearly the product that it had been earlier. Also bringing in talent that maybe wasn't on par with what they had in the past.
And, you know, I mean, a lot of territories were dealing with that. It was just hard to compete with a much slicker product with the bigger stars and things. And, you know, it probably would have ended at some point anyway, but the, you know, dealing with the commission and everything did not make, you know, fighting McMahon any easier.
Well, they actually, the commission shut Portland Wrestling down for a week in November of 88, because Matt Bourne, he cut himself, and he did it blatantly on TV. And so the commission shut him down for going against the rules. And I guess if they really wanted to play hardball, they could have just shut him down permanently. But then again, they're making money off Portland Wrestling and off all the house shows around the state, so they'd be losing money. But after Matt did that, then that was the last time you saw blood in Portland.
There were a lot of things going on. We should probably talk about the big feud between Roddy Piper and Buddy Rose. That was a huge, huge feud in 1980 and 79, and it drew probably, I guess, you know, one of the bigger houses and one of the bigger payoffs that Don Owen ever did when they finally built up to the hair match with Buddy Rose and then the loser leave town with Buddy Rose and Roddy Piper. So a lot of big deals in that feud.
That was something that was amazing. It started out as a I'm trying to remember back now. It was I believe it was Roddy or Buddy had the heavyweight belt, and Roddy and Killer Brooks had the tag belts. They go up and do an interview, and they have all of their belts in a wheelbarrow. Look, we're the best. No one can beat us. We're the best four. You bring any four to go against us, and we'll beat them. And so that set up a match with Wiskowski, Rose, Piper, Brooks against, I'm trying to remember now, it was Savage,
I think it was George Wells, was it Adrian Adonis and Ron Starr?
Yeah, maybe, yes, yeah, that was it, yeah, it was, one of the Guerreros, yes, that was it. And it's amazing how the mind kind of goes away after a while. But,
yeah.
Brooks does a was going to do a was on the mat and was being covered by, I believe it was Savage, and Wiskowski gets up on the top rope and does a head drop, and Savage moves and gets Brooks. That starts off the big feud. But it wasn't until about a month after that the big feud with Piper and Rose started. And you're right, it was money. These guys were made to have a program with each other, and it lasted. The big blow off was in the summer of 80, so it was a full year that they did this with the Loser Leaf Town match at the Portland Exposition Center, and that was another one where they, in hindsight, I don't know why they wouldn't use the Coliseum at that point, but they still had thousands and thousands of people for the blow off at the Portland Expo Center. But you're right, it was the hair match was a big part of it early on, and I think that's what really kind of got the feud had been going on for 6-7 months, and the hair match got it lit the fuse again and got people really into it. But as far as feuds in Portland, that was probably number one, because it it was during a time when it was a short enough time ago that people still remember it extremely well, but it was also so planned out. Unlike the Ramos Savage feud, there was a lot more. That was just more talk back and forth. With Piper and Rose, you had two guys that were amazing on the mic. This is where Piper, I think, really blossomed as far as how he could work the mic. And so it was. I think this feud really made Piper the star that he became.
Yeah, it really. I mean, Piper even says that's how they made each other through that feud. And yeah, it was a great feud. I just tweeted out that match we're talking about, that elimination match. I just tweeted it out, so if you want to watch it, you can watch it at Jim Valley on Twitter. But it is on YouTube. If you just search for Buddy Rose and Roddy Piper, it'll be one of the top searches. If you want to,
I will say that match is one that is available because of Buddy, and Buddy originally taped that match.
Well, and let's talk about that, because Buddy, I mentioned before you came on that Buddy was an early adopter.
Yes,
some formats that predate VHS.
Yes, he early on when I got to know Buddy, I would say, boy, I would love to see video of Lonnie Mane wrestling in Portland. And he says, I have some. Well, God, where is it? And it was a year or two later until he finally gave me all these tapes. And they were tapes that I had not seen before. They were like twice the size of a VHS tape. And I went through the tapes, and one of them said 1077 Rose, Maine. And I'm thinking, God, I don't care what it takes. I have got to see this. And so it took me about a year to find out what the format was. Like you mentioned, I worked for the Trailblazers, and there were lots of Blazer fans that worked, or a lot of wrestling fans that worked for the Blazers at the time, and they were all trying to find what this format is. And it was a format put out by Quasar in 1975 to 77 called The Great Time Machine. And so once I found that, then I go looking to see, how do I get these transferred? And I finally found a place back in Pennsylvania that could transfer these over. And so I sent them a couple of tapes, and then I actually found a machine by myself. These machines, it's a top-loading machine, weighs about 60 pounds. And the machine I got didn't work. Fortunately, there was a place here in Portland that would repair them. And so I went through, and Buddy never labeled anything. So I'm going through and trying to find all these things. And sure enough, there is Lonnie Maine. I'm going, holy, I found the holy grail of Portland wrestling here. And also on one of these tapes was the beginning of that Piper-Rose feud with that eight-man tag match, elimination match, and also the interview that led up to it. And that's what you find on YouTube now. But that was the start of kind of unearthing all of Buddy's great video collection that he had.
Yeah, I mean, and we appreciate all of the work you've done, because it definitely preserves Portland wrestling history, and people can see, and hopefully during this time that we spent with you this morning, Rich, that people see that there's more to Buddy Rose than just the blowaway diet, and maybe now people have a slightly better knowledge of what happens in Portland wrestling. We got to run, but we'll have to have you on again. We'll have to do this again sometime.
Thank you, Jim. I appreciate it. Have a great 4th of July weekend. Be safe, and like I said, thank God for Buddy Rose for saving all that Portland wrestling footage so we can all enjoy it and know what Portland wrestling was all about.
And thank you, Rich. I appreciate everything, and we'll definitely get you on again. I hope you enjoyed this.
Okay, thank you very much, Jim. Have a good day.
All right, there's the very popular Rich Patterson from the Portland Trailblazers and a longtime friend of Buddy Rose and a longtime fan there of Portland wrestling here on the live cast. Well, yeah, if you're in the United States, enjoy your Independence Day 3-day weekend. If you're not, still enjoy your weekend anyway and have a great time. Next week on the show, someone wanted to talk to somebody from the 605 Crockett Saturday show. So I got perennial North Carolina wrestler underneath the eye and entertainer George South. George South is going to be here next week on the live cast, taking your calls and all that fun stuff. So have a great week. We'll talk to you then. Follow me on Twitter at Jim Valley, and we will see you next time on Saturday Morning Wrestling. This is live.